Hey, it's Ian. Just a quick preface before this episode. We were out late the previous night before we recorded with a special patron-only Politics in the Pub night that we forgot to thank everyone for coming out to. If you want to be on the list for those in the future, go over to patreon.com/politicoast and sign up as one of our supporters, and we'll let you know next time we throw one of those together. It was a lot of fun, and we'll definitely do it again. That said, we might have been a little bit more tired than usual during this episode, so if any of our analysis is subpar, that's why. Blame the beer.
One of my favorite things about Agincourt, Ontario, is apparently got its name in the most Canadian way possible, which was a bunch of Anglos trying to piss off the French by naming it after a famous English victory over the French.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicoast. Today is November 9th, 2017, and this is episode 61. Politicoast is a podcast that explores what's happening in British Columbia and across the country. If you haven't already, make sure to subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, where we're at Politicoast Pod, and support the show at patreon.com/politicoast.
I'm Scott.
And I'm Ian. Today, we're talking about whether MLA should call each other names, whether Canada's actually ever going to do any peacekeeping, and we have an interview about supply management. So fun show today. First, of course, we have to thank our premier sponsor, Lindsay Tedds. Thanks again for helping make the show possible.
So before we jump into our main segment, well, we have a little feedback to discuss. Last Friday's episode had our interview with Hector Bremner. We got some feedback on that one.
Yeah, people don't like him. I mean, he got 28% of 11% of the vote. So that means over 70% of the people who did vote didn't vote for him and generally voted for candidates to the left of him, which was all of them. But the feedback was not just on that. I mean, there were some tweets at us that people just told us on the street. Someone emailed us directly. And the criticism mostly falls in the, oh, did you just let him get away with talking about everything? And I think it comes back to how we've only done a handful of interviews with sitting politicians. We did David Eby back during the election. We did Nikki Ashton during the summer. And now we've done Hector Bremner. And in each of those, I think we've generally taken a very friendly kind of, ask them a very detailed policy question and then let them go. And from there, sometimes they address policy. More often they just sort of turn and spin into policy talking points and things like that. And sometimes it's a bit more interesting. I think at the very least, it gives enough rope for a politician to hang himself or herself. And even if you disagree, you can at least start to see the contradictions if that's what you want to see in there.
Yeah, I actually kind of like those format interviews when I'm listening to, you know, someone else doing them. And it's because you get to kind of hear more than just the very brief little talking point, and they get to elaborate on their views. And Hector was very verbose. You know, I thought it was interesting kind of what it revealed. And but at the same time, we probably should have pushed back on a few things. I know I think I did a bit of a double take when we were doing it, when he started talking about proportional representation, and might have been a good idea to push back on that and a few other things.
Well, and he jumps into very partisan talking points at those points. He would talk earlier in the interview about reaching across the aisle, taking the best ideas, and then suddenly the NDP is gerrymandering the electoral reform referendum and has decided to line its own pockets while ending big money in politics. And it's just a bad look, at the very least. But that's on him, I guess.
Yeah, that was the thing that I think threw me the most, and was the most kind of what the fuck moment in the interview. And yeah, it might be a good idea to push back on it, but we also weren't really there to kind of discuss provincial electoral reform. So I kind of decided it was just move past there rather than going off on that tangent, because we didn't even get through all of our questions and we talked for an hour.
Yeah. And half of those are up on our Patreon. So if you want to hear more about his thoughts on spot rezoning, congestion pricing, what he thinks of Sam Sullivan, I think, which is a lot of just sort of talking points that'll lead into the next election. Those are there. The other thing I think we could have pushed back on is when we asked him about challenges of demand and speculation, those kind of things in the market. He just pivoted it to, well, that's all just racist xenophobic, anti-immigrant nonsense. It's like, well,
there's a fair bit of it, but it's not all.
Yeah. And we weren't going to, in the end, I think, change his mind. And so, I don't know. If people really don't like those, if they like those kind of interviews, let us know. I really enjoy talking to the academics and the activists who don't have that must spin everything to fit this mold, but can just rant about an issue. And I think we have a lot of fun with those.
Yeah, I've always enjoyed those ones, I think, a little more. And I guess on the other side of things, I wasn't there when you talked to Nikki Ashton, but I think I had a fairly similar point of view to a lot of the feedback we got just kind of from the other side, going like, why aren't you asking a follow-up question on this complete, well, what seemed to be completely insane talking point, or whatever, or at least talking point I very much disagreed on.
I guess we can move on from that. The other thing we've heard a lot this past week was people really like Stephen Carter. I think possibly more than us. Maybe we need to swear a lot more, be really angry. The only negative feedback I think I got is a text from my wife, which I got after the recording, where she was actually worried that he was yelling at us instead of not with us, but around us about politics in general. And apparently people want him back on the show at least monthly. I worry at some point he would just replace us, but he had his own podcast and hashtag fucking Corey Hogan nuked it, I guess. But I think there's a role for him as our official Alberta correspondent, let's say. And finally, I got one email about a technical issue with the show. Someone was having issues playing our podcast on their phone, and I guess it has something to do with how I was encoding the file format. So I'm going to try something a little bit more universally compatible. So if you're having any technical issues, hopefully those don't come through anymore. But if you do have issues, email me, ian@politicos.ca, and I'll try to fix that. Well, segment one, does the ledge need an explicit tag? There's been quite a bit of ruckus in the legislature recently. It surprisingly is not calming down, despite being this minority situation where everyone needs to work together to get bills passed. The tensions have reached sort of a pinnacle this past week as the Speaker, Darrell Plekis, has been ruling that many of the comments made by the Liberals, who are in his former caucus, are unparliamentary language. This dates back at least a week or two to when Peter Miliband first referred to Agriculture Minister Lana Popham as the Minister of Intimidation. And then this week, we had Jazz Johal talking about Minister of Transportation Claire Trevana as the Minister of Consultation Paralysis. She's also been called the Minister of Gridlock, the Minister of Taxis. Someone was called the Minister of Job Loss. Someone called John Horgan the Minister of Defense. And it's this childish level of mocking titles as a way to, I don't know, score cheap political points. I don't know that anyone's actually paying that close attention other than a handful of politicos that write for the Vancouver Sun and Province. But the Speaker ruled at first that this was out of order, and Mike DeYoung of the BC Liberals consulted all his deepest depths of parliamentary procedures and knowledge and figured maybe we can get away with this. So he pushed back and actually challenged the Speaker, and he's challenged the Speaker again. And they've refused to withdraw these comments, so now there's this standoff, and Plekis has essentially concluded that the unofficial and at times mocking or derogatory titles when directing a question to a minister of the crown is indeed disrespectful to the minister and reflects poorly on this institution. And he's even gone on to say further challenges are unacceptable and will not be tolerated in the future, suggesting he might throw someone out, which would be pretty intense for a parliament that's right now 41-41-3 with a vacancy and an independent, because Plekis, as we'll all remember, was kicked out of his caucus for taking the job as Speaker, which is apparently not a thankful one these days.
And the kicking people out, I think, is where this has the most potential consequence and where it gets the most interesting. People complain about the decorum in the various legislatures.
Or the lack thereof.
Yeah. And legislatures and parliaments for years, and minor change one way or the other in the long run isn't going to really make much of a difference. But the really interesting thing here is, yeah, what happens if people keep pushing on this one and the balance of the legislature ends up shifting when someone gets booted?
Well, the other angle to this is the historical partisanship of this, because these kind of mocking titles aren't new in BC. Even just before the Liberal government fell, you had Andrew Weaver calling Rich Coleman, who's now the interim leader, the Minister of Hot Air. John Horgan's called Andrew Wilkinson the Minister of Propaganda. Shane Simpson's called Mike DeYoung the Minister of Broken Promises. And so it's all quite petty. The Greens and NDP are now saying they support the Speaker's ruling. They want to see better decorum. And they recognize they haven't always been at their best in the past. And maybe it's time they shape up as a group of MLAs. But then that also seems opportunistic, since they're not the ones being chastised and they're also in government, or at least the NDP is, with the Greens sharing agreement. Rich Coleman, of course, can't miss an opportunity to be petty. And yesterday, when he was outside the legislature, figured, I guess someone asked what his nickname for Plekis would be, and he just replied, incompetent.
Which isn't a nickname.
No, it's just an adjective. So the background here, our parliamentary system coming back from the UK's Westminster system is based on this formalistic idea that I think is supposed to encourage decorum. So people have to address the speaker rather than other members. So everyone talks through the speaker, and ideally that cuts down on the partisan barbs. They also can't use people's names. They have to refer to people by their title. So they'll say the honorable member from Kelowna West or whatever, or the honorable minister of transportation. And there's also this like long and growing list of things you're not allowed to say that have just been ruled unparliamentary language. The majority of them are don't call people liars, dishonest, or hypocrites. But then just the precedents, and this is an iPolitics article that we'll link to that has 106 things you can't say, but we won't read them all. Some of my favorites in there include saying someone is inspired by 40 rod whiskey. You can't call them a parliamentary babe and suckling. You can't say the political sewer pipe from Carlton County. You can't talk about Canadian Mussolini or Nazis, I guess. Or members who've aligned themselves with the murderers in Quebec, which was ruled out of order in 1970 for some reason. So there's all kinds of these little things, and I guess you can add the ministers of taxis and the minister of hot air to this list now. The worst part about this for me is none of these are that offensive or even that clever. They're just all kind of like childish taunts.
Yeah, it's a little rhetorical flourish, but yeah, there's nothing particularly inspired about them. But at the same time, it's not, you know, calling someone a piece of shit, which has happened, not in BC, but federally.
There's also, at the federal level, been people talk about golden showers, and I guess that's what triggered this iPolitics article. But this all triggers the question of, is it the speaker's role to, in the Liberals' language, unilaterally and dictatorially change the rules of Parliament? Because in general, these rules are set by Parliament as a whole, by all the sitting elected officials, and they write up the standing orders, and then those are interpreted by the speaker. And so in this case, I think they're alleging that he's going above and beyond his remit and just arbitrarily deciding things are out of order when they're not that bad. They're just kind of dumb. And of course, they get the traditionalists, I want to say, on side, who, like Keith Baldry, who's on Twitter, he was saying he's seen people complaining about this foul language to the BC legislature, but he imagines none of these people have actually been there, and so why should they be commenting on how bad it is? And it's like, maybe they're not there because it's childish and a waste of time, and more stuff is happening outside question period than inside it these days. Although then, of course, I watched a little bit of Green MLA Sonia Furstenau's speech to try to defend the speaker's ruling. She compared making this change to ending slavery as a level of vote that, you know, sometimes we have to go against tradition. If we didn't go against tradition, we'd still have slavery. I'm like,
that's reaching.
Yeah.
That is very much reach.
A little problematic too, maybe. This is dumb words in Parliament. So this will be one for the parliamentary nerds and wonks to dive into and figure out who's in the right side. In the short term, it feels like it's just going to keep getting heated and be this standoff. I can't imagine Plekis wants to throw anyone out. That would look pretty bad in this, you know, razor's edge situation. But he doesn't have a lot of other tools in his chest.
Yeah, and if the opposition calls his bluff on it and keeps pushing, you know, he may have to either, you know, step up or back down on it.
Although, what's the Liberals' long game in this? Like, I get that they're pissed at Plekis still, and they're going to take any chance they can to get barbs, but why are they sticking with this fight?
I have no idea on that one. If there is a long-term strategy underlying the Liberals, it's not readily apparent.
It's Rich Coleman is mad today.
That really does seem how it goes some days.
Which is quite funny, because during the campaign, it was Hulk Hogan, who we all thought would be too angry. And now, I guess since he's premier, he's got all his dreams have come true. And so he's just running around smiling and happy all the time. And it's the Liberals who are angry and lost.
Moving on to segment two, peacekeeping. What is it good for? So today, Andrew Scheer made an announcement that if he was to form government, Canada would be going on a peacekeeping mission to the Ukraine, specifically to back Ukrainian sovereignty against Russia, which is never going to happen because, well, Russia's going to veto the thing right away at the Security Council. But that didn't stop Andrew Scheer from pitching nonetheless, and some contain a few shots at the Liberals for announcing peacekeeping intentions to try and secure a Security Council seat rather than for any real Canadian interest.
So there's all kinds of things to unpack here, but the first thing I need to vent about is apparently the best thing Andrew Scheer can find to do 280 characters with on Twitter is to preface a tweet with making an important announcement this afternoon, colon. That's not helpful. It's a tweet. It's already an announcement. And then it's then followed by a stream of to his credit, shorter and shorter tweets. But I know we'll be over the 280 characters thing like yesterday, but it's not helpful, Twitter. Also, I want my verified check, but apparently Nazis ruined it for everyone, like they ruin everything. Also with Andrew Scheer's Twitter, let's just point out how his profile pic is his Snapchat link thing. Neither of us use Snapchat, so we don't get it, but it's dumb looking. And his URL on his Twitter profile page goes to his Facebook. So he wants you on all his social media. But this proposal from Ukraine, I guess, came out in the last couple days where they're trying to pitch this to the UN Security Council that to end the battles that are ongoing between the Russian-backed separatists and the Ukrainian government that's trying to hold its land, they suggest the UN Security Council approve a peacekeeping mission where UN peacekeepers will come in and defend the original borders. And basically, all the Russian aggressors, in Andrew Scheer's words, will have to leave. And then the peacekeepers will just make sure everything's peachy cozy, which sounds less like peacekeeping to me and more like joining the Ukrainian side in the conflict and just fighting their battle for them, which is a debate we can have. I just don't know if we can call it peacekeeping at that point. I guess since it's coming from the UN, it would be technically peacekeepers.
Yeah, so this would be the sort of thing where peacekeeper, you know, would kind of make sense if it wasn't against a Security Council permanent member. So like peacekeeping's kind of fallen by the wayside of it in kind of the last 30 years. And a large amount of that has to do with kind of the changing international security environment and the fact that the kind of initial peacekeeping model worked pretty well when you could kind of plop yourself down between two armies that didn't really want to fight or didn't want to drag you into it either. But it's less and less, it's been less and less useful kind of as non-state actors arise or, well, permanent members of the Security Council back people or or in what's happening in the Ukraine's case, where kind of you get this hybrid warfare scenario where you don't have armies kind of out in the open, you know, wearing Russian flags, going around shooting at people. And so it's not something you can easily kind of plop down your kind of standard UN peacekeeping model onto.
And everyone's already mocked Scheer relentlessly for the obvious point that Russia will obviously veto any peacekeeping plan that tells it to leave Ukraine and Crimea. So his proposal's a non-starter, or his support for the Ukrainian proposal's a non-starter. Russia, for its part, I guess to give both sides, has pitched its own counterproposal to, quote, freeze the incursion. So peacekeeping troops in that case would just monitor the front line between Ukrainian and Russian forces, which I guess is more traditional peacekeeping, but doesn't really satisfy the Ukrainian government, doesn't satisfy Ukrainian Canadians, and essentially rewards and grants Crimea to Russia, which the West has already kind of done by not wanting to get into an armed conflict with a superpower, understandably. The Liberals are considering Ukraine's proposal, but they haven't announced what they're going to do. Trudeau, shortly after being elected, I guess, he announced Canada's going to put 600 Canadian Armed Forces personnel and 150 police officers to future UN peace operations. But since then, literally nothing has been announced. We don't know if they're ever going to be deployed. Supposedly, there'll be an announcement, maybe, after this UN peacekeeping conference that's actually going to happen here in Vancouver next week. We didn't get invited. Not bitter about that. I guess we'll wait and see what Harjit Sajjan has to announce. Maybe they'll endorse the Ukrainian proposal, but it still feels like it's not going to get the Russian buy-in it needs.
Yeah, and also the other thing is, peacekeepers, you generally want a neutral force to be the peacekeeping force, and Canada's just not neutral in this conflict at all. We've been backing the Ukrainians, we have troops in Ukraine teaching the Ukrainians how to wage war, and we've been very critical of the Russian actions on this. And we have forces in the Baltics to kind of shore up that area specifically as a reaction to the Russian adventures in Ukraine. And as a NATO member, there's simply no way we're going to be perceived as a neutral party in this. So I really have no problem with us backing the Ukrainians in this one, but we should be clear, it's not going to be a peacekeeping mission.
Well, for our third segment, we have an interview we recorded a couple weeks ago with John Hordick, one of our listeners who grew up on a farm and wanted to give us his perspective on supply management. So I hope you enjoy some wonky discussion about eggs and chickens and what it's like growing up on a farm. We're sitting down here on a Saturday afternoon with listener and friend of the show, John Hordick. Thanks for joining us, John.
No worries.
So you wanted to come in, yell at us essentially, because you find we tend to be, or at least Scott especially, tends to be overly negative about supply management, but you grew up on a farm that was supply managed.
Right. First 9 years of my life, I was my father owned a farm, a chicken breeder farm, and he bought that in 1980. So the chicken breeder quota, the product he sold was fertilized eggs. And in Ontario, chicken breeder eggs became supply managed, and I think in 86, it was one of the last ones. And then when we were in 1989, I would have been about 7 years old, he sold the farm and started managing turkey farms, turkey broilers. So those are turkeys that are sent for meat. And then through my teenage years, I worked on dairy farms, which I think was one of the first commodities that were supply managed.
And one of the biggest.
Definitely by far the biggest. Yeah. Yeah. And so I haven't really been involved with it since 2006, 2007. I did a little bit of reading before I came here, just to make sure I wasn't completely out of date. So yeah, definitely had the contrast between, you know, people in the community who had beef or pork versus the dairy or poultry farmers, and you saw the contrast of that, of those two systems growing up, and culturally how, you know, the supply management seemed to really stabilize things for those farms and those commodities.
Well, and even for myself, I grew up in southern Alberta, and my dad mostly had a grain farm, but we did have egg-laying chickens.
Yeah.
I didn't really pay attention to the economics of the farm other than if it hailed, we had to rely on crop insurance to basically make sure we could plant again next year. And it was never really a profitable farm. But the egg-laying was supply managed, I realized, because when he got out of it, he sold the quota to a Hutterite colony because they had much better technology, and the cost of doing business for my dad on a day-to-day basis just wasn't worth it. He'd have to totally renovate this old barn that was just, like, if you ever watch Napoleon Dynamite, when he's picking eggs there in the three layers of cages that with the hens three to a cage smaller than this little table we have here. It's great to talk about visual things on a podcast. Those chickens that just like live a miserable life and shit through the cage onto the floor. Yeah, I picked eggs in one of those. The only difference was we had two layers of eggs. And so it was a pretty miserable thing. Those chickens only live about a year with us, and then we get new chickens as part of the quota. So it would have needed a lot of renovations. Definitely not up to Vancouver level animal ethics, I think, either.
One of my close friends, her parents sold her dairy quota and got into chicken layers. Every time we used the word cages, this would have been about 2002, 2003. Her dad corrected me and said, no, they're apartments. They're chicken apartments these days. So.
A bit of a euphemism there.
Yeah, for sure. But he definitely went from one supply managed commodity, you know, to the next. And one of the downsides to, we'll probably get into that, to supply management is he was one of the few people who could get into chicken layers because he just sold his dairy quota to go to another one. The difference socially as a kid, you hear about your friends whose dads were hog farmers and the market was boom and bust, you know, like when it was great, their new pickup trucks and new backpacks at school. And if it was bust, well, you hear about farmers gassing whole barns full of pigs, and sometimes themselves. You'd hear that through the farmer's grapevine, which I'm sure is as reliable as any other source. But the farmers that had the supply managed, you know, always seemed to be, you know, come hell or high water, always seemed to do just fine.
Yeah. And well, that's always been the selling point, though, is it helps the farmers. But I don't think anyone's ever criticized it for not helping farmers enough. The criticism always seems to be more on the other end of the market there, and where people are actually having to buy the products and the transfer of expenses onto the people. Because yeah, sure, the farmers made a lot of money, but that money also has to come from the consumers,
right? And I think the debate then becomes, what system is ideal and where do we go from here? In the farming community, there's a lot of debate about whether or not they should have got into supply management. When I last milked cows, quota is bought and sold in kilos of butterfat, and one cow puts out about a kilo of butterfat a day. So it was $30,000 when I got out of it. So that's $30,000 a cow just for the license to ship the milk. In Ontario now, I think they've capped it to $24,000 a kilo, which seems to have maybe broken the system, because last month there was people were looking for over thousands of kilos of butterfat, but there was only 400 that were up for sale. So I'm not sure whether the system works anymore as soon as they put a cap on it. So the way that they implemented it, for the listeners who are from Vancouver and are not didn't grow up in this in agriculture area, the way they implemented it in the first case is everyone in Ontario or BC or whatever, if you put out 1% of the milk, you got 1% of the quota. It was a cap and trade. And then farmers just ended up buying and selling quota, and the price kept on going up and up and up. And, oh, in BC, that cap is $44,000 for a kilo of butterfat. So they also put a cap in. I'm not sure if the market rate has reached that yet. So as a farmer would sell his farm. Maybe it's too many Dutch family, too many kids, couldn't divide the farm eight ways. They sell the farm, and other farmers would buy that quota from him, and that's what they would retire from, sell the farm and the quota. And eventually got to the point where the quota was worth more than the farm, the cows, the equipment, and all this stuff. Or, you know, and all the majority of his assets were tied up in the quota. But it resulted in a few things that I think were advantageous to Canadians. We don't need to subsidize our farms like they do in the States. The price we pay pays for the whole system. There's no money going in the back door through subsidies like they have in the States. If they decided to import milk from the States, well, a lot of that milk would be subsidized. So one of the other advantages is the farmers indirectly and the milk boards directly put in quality standards or standards about how they're supposed to be treated or what hormones they can use. I don't know if it's still the case, but for a while in the States, a heifer, which is a female cow that hasn't had a calf, will be bred and have one calf, and that starts a lactation. Then after 8 to 10 months, she starts to dry up. And in the States, it would give her an injection, a hormone, and she can start a lactation cycle again. That's illegal in Canada. They're required to be bred and have a period of rest before they have a calf again and a new lactation cycle.
Well, and this is why so many farmers that I know and ranchers get so annoyed at A&W ads and these other like hormone-free cows will always have hormone-free beef. And I'm like, all fucking beef in this country is hormone-free. Like, you can tone down the marketing.
There's a lot of hormones in natural meat. Yeah. No artificial.
No added.
No added hormones, yes. And we could probably get into debate whether that milk is still fine. It is probably, the milk in the States, due to the hormones, is almost certainly just as safe as the Canadian milk. However, it's not great for the cows from a animal welfare standpoint.
Right, but you mentioned all beef, and that's not supply managed where dairy is. So is there any reason why the quality part would need to be tied to supply management? Because like, most of the calories produced by our agriculture sector are not from supply managed crops or products, yet we managed to maintain decent health and safety standards on those.
I guess the mechanism of change would be, you'd still be able to put those restrictions without the supply management program, for sure. If they have a lot of price pressure or it's not profitable, a farmer is more likely to cut corners. Enforcement then becomes an issue.
I guess one of the growing concerns around supply management is just the ideal is maintaining the small family farms like right. We both grew up on, but like you're saying, it has become such a big asset, the biggest asset that a farm has, that it's just tempting to retire and to get that big paycheck, move to a smaller farm, just do a little bit of grain or whatever else. And so you're seeing this amalgamation of family farms in this sort of growing corporatization. In US, family farms have disappeared. In Canada, they're start going about the same pace. So it seems like for the ideal goal, it's not necessarily holding up, even though it may have benefited families like ours for a certain amount of time.
Oh, that's definitely an effect that it has had, is making it difficult for young people to get into farming. But that's the case with many industries, beef as well. Grain, a combine is well over $500,000. But it has reduced the growth of farms substantially compared to the States. The average farm in Canada, I looked up for this interview, is 90 cows still. There are some that are quite a bit larger. There's not so many of the 30, 40 cow operations anymore. If a farmer does have 30, 40 cows, he probably doesn't have any debt. And that's, you know, it's not going to be sustainable in the too distant future. However, in the States, the average cow size is much, much larger. They have areas of 11,000 cows all in one area, all that environmental impact in one area. And they're, you know, trucking the manure how far away
and the risk of disease and all the other
right,
problems yeah. that can come with large scale farming.
Yeah. It hasn't solved the problem of trying to keep it smaller scale and more dispersed, but it's definitely slowed down the growth of farms.
Yeah, so like you mentioned that running a combine is pretty expensive, but you don't actually have to pay to get permission to run the combine compared to, say, milking a cow and then selling the products there. So yeah, I see that as kind of one of the downsides there. I just want to circle back on to something we were talking about earlier, where you were discussing about how we don't have to subsidize our industry here compared to the other ones. But considering that food is one of the major expenses of a lot of families, particularly lower income families, is it not a more progressive system to fund whatever that shortfall is out of general revenues as a subsidy rather than from the consumer?
So instead of having direct subsidies from the government to farms, supply management basically forces the funding burden onto the backs of consumers.
Whereas if it
is
was,
what he's arguing.
Whereas if it was just a subsidy, it would come out of general revenues, and which is largely funded by a progressive income tax.
Mm-hmm.
So assuming there needs to be some sort of way to make up wherever the gap is between the economics with no intervention at all for farms and what they need to function, you know, whether that be subsidy or supply management, would it not make more sense to use a subsidy rather than supply management from a distributional aspect?
Or you could just reduce the taxes on the poor so they could afford the, you know, there's a lot of different, you could either give the money to the poor, or you give the money to the farmers, or just have it cost what it costs to produce. You could subsidize. There's many different angles, and I'm not sure which way is. I think a big one, and I'm not sure about this, is like there was debate about whether or not it would be. So it was pretty much a cap and trade system that they ended up with. Although not that cap is definitely movable, but the trade aspect is still there. Whether or not supply management was the way to go, where do we go from here? How do you all those assets, which billion? I think I back of an envelope. I think it came up with $24 billion worth of quota just for dairy alone.
I've seen 30 to 50 billion for the systems.
Okay, yeah. And I just went with Ontario's price, so that kind of makes sense. How do you get out of that system now?
Well, do you have any thoughts on Australia's and New Zealand's history with removing supply management?
I didn't look into that, no.
Okay. Yeah.
Do you know anything about that?
Yeah.
I know that they have done it.
Yeah, I think both of them did it around the early 2000s, and they did a slow phase out, and there was, I believe, some compensation for the quotas.
Because
That's the tough part that I think you're raising, John, is we have this like massive asset that's essentially just a fiction.
Mm-hmm.
It's a government-forced fiction, and if we turn it off, all that money just disappears, which could destroy families.
I do remember
a little like taxi cab medallions.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's the exact same kind of system,
yeah,
right?
It's a cartel.
It's an artificially created scarce resource.
Yeah.
Right. Although if we go with just, you know, subsidies, how do you prevent farmers from overproducing, building barns, killing cows when the price crashes? You get that boom and bust cycle again.
Yeah, that was one of the things when I was doing my little bit of reading up that I don't think about as much is when you go to the grocery store as a consumer in Canada, milk is always going to cost the same amount, or there'll be some minor inflation. And it has risen faster than inflation, which is a problem for supply management, but it's consistent. Whether it's summer, winter, there's not just a random, milk is suddenly three times as expensive. And for most people, that fluctuation in, say, the cost of beef or some other groceries or vegetables, for example, doesn't matter as much because the grocery bill doesn't tend to make up the most portion of middle class and upper class people. But food is a staple of everyone. Everyone needs to buy food, and it's the marginalized who end up paying the most. And of course, supply management has inflated our prices, but it's also stabilized them.
And whether it's crops, you have this much land. It's not like, soys are suddenly worth twice as much, I'm going to plant twice as, you can't just go out and make more land. You can build more hog barns. And by the time your hogs are coming to market, everyone else's is, and suddenly you're up shit creek. We can swear on this podcast. Yeah. Right? Yeah. But it's not like a, it's not like a mine where, oh, the price of whatever is down, like, we'll just stop production for a while. Like when it comes to especially animal production, that the response to commodity prices is very slowly what you're planning for and what you end up with. But if you decide to expand your barns and, you know, breed more cows, hopefully you get heifers, not bulls, but you know, like you try you, that stabilization has really improves everything from the lives of farmers for sure. They have awesome pickup trucks
in the booms.
So dairy farmers always were the wealthy ones. Same with the egg layers and that kind of thing. They always seem to do fairly well, but you're not gassing cows because you have too much. Then that's a animal rights thing or animal welfare. You're not having empty barns that are doing nothing, nothing for you. It's difficult to respond to changes in commodities when it's that much infrastructure and actual animal lives in the balance.
But on the other hand, there's also a lot of other industries that are pretty capital intensive and take long lead times to ramp up their production, yet it's not government policy to soften those fluctuations in the market. So why should it just be this one sector? Why don't we do it for cars, for example, or anything else like that?
I think one answer to that would be one family's income is tied to this, where if it's a mine, that risk is often diversified, not so much for the workers, but for the people who own the capital.
Yeah, it's a centrally planned system that favors small business owners. Sounds like the most Canadian thing ever.
Although it's not so small anymore.
Yeah.
I think the only supply management system that we've gotten rid of in Canada would be tobacco. But that one, they just allowed more tobacco to come in from overseas until the point where the quota was essentially worthless. And then they bought them out for pennies for what people had originally paid for the quota.
Well, that raises the question, shouldn't we be talking about bringing supply management in for cannabis distribution?
That's a good point.
I don't think anyone's thought of this. Yeah. Probably because it's, yeah.
I can see several very angry Andrew Coyne columns in the future that was to get suggested.
Switching gears, one of my last questions, I don't need to keep going on this for too long, but as long as we're all happy. Growing up in rural Canada, as we both did, it's a very sort of small C conservative voting, at least now, historically had some different roots, but the Conservative Party also has this awkward dual life inside of it, with the libertarian end wanting to scrap supply management and the more rural focused, maybe even wanting to maintain it and not upset farmers. How did you see those kind of conversations when you were growing up, as much as you paid attention?
We were usually, or like through the 90s, early to mid 90s in our riding, the MP was usually a liberal. He was a pro-life liberal, as much as he could be. And
there were some of those before.
And I don't remember his name, but he was, he had a lot of support because of the liberal support of the, of supply management. And there was a lot of people who admitted they were a single issue voter when it came to that thing. But during the Chrétien years, they said a conservative in the Liberal Party was better than a conservative in the
reform or alliance
or whatever it was. Yeah. And then, although my parents and my always voted Christian Heritage Party, my dad's cousin is a president of the Christian Heritage Party. So my parents had lots of bad things to say about the liberals. Yeah. I think the Christian Heritage Party was pro supply management, if you believe that, at least back then. I don't know if they still are.
I looked up the platform of the guy who just ran in Sturgeon, Park River, whatever, outside Edmonton, in Ron Ambrose's old seat, and his website mentioned that he's among all these standard pro-life, anti-choice, anti-gay marriage, also bringing naturopathy into the Canadian healthcare system. Just randomly. So
last time I looked at their website, one of their arguments against abortion was because it became fetuses became a delicacy in China.
They'll find anything they can use.
Definitely getting off topic here.
Yeah.
Well, since we're talking the politics of it, supply management's come up in the context of the NAFTA renegotiations.
Right.
Do you think this is an area it's worth sticking to our guns with, even if it hurts us in other areas?
This is how we started talking about this in the first place. Why I missed
either it. Yeah. NAFTA or yeah. CETA or
one of the trade agreements. I have no, as I said, I have no idea how we would get rid of supply management in the first place. Whether or not it was the right system in the first place, some people say they should have went to a system where it was a tax, like, you know, talk about carbon cap and trade mm-hmm. versus carbon tax. Well, I don't think that would have limited the growth of farms if they did something like that back in the 70s. But to get out of the system we have now, where it's worth up to $50 billion, meanwhile, milk is worth about 24, the dairy industry as a whole is worth about $24 billion a year in Canada. without having a whole bunch of farmers go tits up and getting those massive farms that you have in the States, this would be potentially, it is a poison pill for the Trump trying to get rid of NAFTA or whatever. I think it's the few thousand dairy farmers across Canada, that's a pretty small voting block. Not to mention all the chicken broilers and the... did we mention for listeners what's all supply management in Canada? It's dairy, chicken broilers, chicken eggs, the eggs that you eat, layer hens, chicken breeder eggs. Those are where the eggs are... the hens and the roosters are free to roam and do whatever they want. And then those eggs go to a hatchery. Those are supply managed. And turkey meat is also supply managed in Canada. But to get rid of the quota on all those industries at once is going to be a huge hit to the agriculture sector. I think we're going to lose a lot of the family farms, whether there's value to that or not. I think there is. You're losing that slowly anyways, but I think it would really increase the rate. But in the whole face of NAFTA, whether or not that would be enough to stop the negotiations, I definitely don't know.
I feel like at this point, Trump is just screwing around and
looking
not,
for its use to
well, and not, the whole thing and up. Not negotiating in good faith. So basically just trying to throw getting his team to throw whatever else out there they can and changing things and just messing around. So
I think he's looking for a win. And when he heard that the dairy farmers are losing their shirt because of Canadian supply management, not because of U.S. overproduction, he's like, oh, this is a problem I can fix. And at least I'll get Wisconsin on my side. California puts out more milk than Wisconsin now, but you know.
He's never going to win California.
True enough.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for taking the time to sit down with us, John. Yeah. Hopefully we'll do it again sometime, maybe on creationism in schools or something else like we were talking about earlier. But yeah, have a good day.
Yeah, sounds good.
Moving on to Twit Tates, we have some news about the TPP, that's the Trans-Pacific Partnership. So since the U.S. pulled out as basically one of Donald Trump's first actions as president, the other 11 parties too have been quietly talking about in the background. And we got some news today that an agreement might or might not have been reached. So the Japanese economy minister made an announcement that they had reached an agreement in principle on it. And then Mexico came out and said the same thing. Australia looked pretty happy coming out of the meeting. But our government disagreed with that. And International Trade Minister François-Philippe Champagne denied any sort of agreement had been reached. As well, there's other sources with knowledge of the negotiations have made similar revelations. So it's really actually just uncertain whether or not there is an agreement.
I saw one news article from New Zealand dated tomorrow because they're in the future that talked about how the meeting, which is happening in Vietnam right now among a bunch of first ministers, ended with like backslapping and clapping, very bougie stuff, as it's a trade minister meeting. But then it comes out that one country, not Canada, but probably Canada, it sounds like, torpedoed it and raised some last minute objections after everyone had done the backslapping and stuff. And this New Zealand article was very explicit that it wasn't Canada, but then everyone on Twitter was like, it was probably Canada. And as far as I can tell, what we'd be objecting to is what we've sort of been on the fence about, which is protecting French cultural products in Canada, because if we open our market up too much, our precious CBC and everything will be dwarfed by competition from
Australia.
Anime, Japanese anime will destroy the French media market. These talks are always held in secret for obvious reasons, and so we don't know what they've agreed, what the holdup is, or even what the next steps are. I guess they're still in the meetings there, and maybe they'll find an agreement in principle in the next day or two, so maybe by the time this is out, the news will have changed. But as of right now, it's a big question mark.
Yeah, and it's worth remembering here that there was already an agreement, and this is the second agreement now that the U.S. is no longer participating, but, you know, I believe we'd actually signed the thing, and now, well, there's going to be a new version that we'll probably end up signing, so it's going to be interesting to see what kind of this whole kerfuffle and mixed messaging is going to be about when the details finally emerge. But in theory, all the parties were fairly close together at the start of the second round of TPP talks. And I could maybe see some of the countries want to change a few things, especially since the US is out. So,
and New Zealand has a new government that's a bit more left and is...
Yeah, that's actually another...
to the investor state dispute resolution stuff that's come up in every one of these big trade agreements.
Yeah, and it's New Zealand is one of the ones I think would be a reasonably likely candidate for the not Canada party that might have torpedoed it precisely for that reason. But yeah, with the US out of the way, some of the more controversial aspects, particularly around intellectual property and pharmaceuticals, yeah, that's the main country that was pushing for it's out. So, you know, in theory, there could be a less controversial version of it.
Well, and that's what it looks like Angus Reid has found, because they just released a poll of Canadians looking at how much we support or don't support this. And they've been polling this question about the TPP since April 2015. And this recent poll was the first time a majority actually supported it, with 59% to 30% opposed, whereas every previous poll had the opposition greater than the support. My favorite question in here is it worth pursuing even if it angers the US? Which, once you give that clause, I kind of want to answer yes, no matter what the first half of the question is. And 51% of Canadians are like that as well. Only 15% disagree. So Canadians are pretty fine with pissing off Donald Trump at this point. I like that.
They also asked whether or not the TPP would be good for the economy, as well as consumer choices and employment and jobs in your area. Interestingly, only 55% of people said yes to the good for the economy part. So apparently 4% of Canadians think we should go ahead with it, even if it isn't going to be good for the economy. And also interestingly, both consumer choice and good for the economy were in the positive numbers, but jobs and employment had only 28% thinking there was going to be a positive benefit to it, with 55% no impact and 17% for negative.
I think Canadians just have a lot of uncertainty around these big deals. There's maybe the general warm and fuzzy feeling to it right now, as the US has gone nativist and we have an international celebrity as our prime minister talking up globalism. but that what does it mean for you in your daily life is a pretty big open question, because it's really hard to see the effects of these big deals. Just a quick follow-up to our discussion there on the TPP. While editing, I checked the news, and CBC's reporting that it was the Australian and New Zealand news outlets that initially misreported what happened. The story seems to be right now that Justin Trudeau did miss this final meeting after talks somewhat broke down with the Japanese minister, and they've now come out and said there is a agreement in principle, but there's just a few extra items to go over, things like automotive issues and intellectual property. So we'll keep our eye on that, and if there's big news next week, we'll dedicate more time to actually breaking this down. Well, next up, the federal government has announced 4 more by-elections. The riding of Bonavista, Burr, and Trinity in Newfoundland and Labrador, the riding here in BC of South Surrey, White Rock, which was vacated by Diane Watts, who's now running for BC Liberal leader, Battleford's Lloydminster in Saskatchewan, and Scarborough Agincourt in Ontario are all going to be up for election. The only one of these that's probably going to be interesting is South Surrey White Rock. The Newfoundland riding, for example, the Liberals won it with 82% of the vote in 2015, which was a record high for them, but it's been pretty solidly Liberal. The Saskatchewan riding, for example, was conservative with 61% of the vote. And even that downtown Toronto riding was 52% Liberal in the last election to the Conservatives' 38%. So Jagmeet Singh looked at this and went, well, that's a waste of time across the board. And he's already said he's not going to run for any of those, because the NDP, I don't think, has gotten above 20% in any of those in recent history, except maybe the Saskatchewan riding, where they were just the token not conservative candidate.
Yeah, I agree. Basically, our by-election here in BC is going to be the only one that has any potential drama in it, I think. Mostly because there was only that 3-point difference between first and second last time, and candidates haven't been announced yet. But if the Conservatives run someone who isn't, you know, a fairly popular former mayor, they might have a hard time maintaining that narrow lead.
Particularly as I think Andrew Scheer has stuck most of the path from the Harper years. And I don't know that that's going to be as popular in the suburbs as it might be in Alberta and the prairies. Meanwhile, Justin Trudeau has done a lot more to outreach to ethnic communities and will probably have a better chance in Surrey and White Rock than Scheer. The Conservative strength in ethnic and minority communities in the past was actually predicated on Jason Kenney, of all people. As Carter was talking about earlier, Kenney was the guy who could go into these communities and make the connections for the party there and connect with some of the conservative values that are in some immigrant communities. But I feel like the Conservative Party of today has doubled down on the rebel media connections and some of the touching up against the white supremacists over there, which there's some appeal in some immigrant communities for that. But it's a dangerous game, and I can't see it going over well on the whole.
Yeah, even if you find that characterization maybe, yeah, less than charitable description of what the Conservatives have been doing, they haven't really done as well shoring up the gains they had made in the past, nor kind of working that hard to reclaim the lost ground from the blunders they made in the last election towards immigrant communities. And it's going to be a little tough on that respect. On the flip side, though, by-elections tend not to be good for the ruling party, so the Liberals might have their own uphill battle in that respect.
Although Liberals did just pick up a seat in Quebec in a by-election, which suggests they do have some skill at running by-elections. Trudeau went to the riding a number of times, and I guess that means we're going to get to see him here in town a little bit more, for better or worse. But yeah, otherwise the other 3 races will not be that interesting, probably at all.
Moving on to local politics, Vancouver's most controversial development, the BD project in Chinatown at 105 Kiefer is, well, back in the news again. We talked about this a couple months back when went to council, I believe, and it's been discussed a couple times on the podcast, and it was once again rejected, but this time at the Development Permitting Board, which is rather unprecedented. It has happened a few times, but this is a board that generally does, well, permitting approvals, and typically it's for projects that, you know, meet the current zoning requirements and all of that stuff. And the last time they rejected one was 2006. And this rejection followed the meeting where they looked at this, which was swamped with activists. I believe there were over 100 people showed up to speak on it. This project's faced a fair bit of local opposition. And it, yeah, ended up getting rejected on a 2-1 vote.
Yeah, it was expected to be a controversial decision at the city council level. I don't know how many people were expecting the permit board, of all places, to be the spot where this dies. Going forward, this means the BD Development Group will either have to resubmit the proposal for a third time with more tweaks to somehow fit the technical...
Actually, I believe this would be the fifth or sixth submittal. It's gone through a few different variations. So yeah, last time it was killed, it was because of the rezoning that was required. And yeah, they wanted to add a couple more stories above what was zoned for. And in exchange, they were going to put in some social housing as part of it. And after that was killed, they went back and just like, okay, we'll put something in according to what, you know, the city development policy says we can build here, which is why this has, I think, caught a lot of people by surprise, even though it was expected to be controversial.
BD's other two options are to maybe try to get a land swap deal with the city, find a different plot of land to put their buildings on.
And this has, I believe there's been talk in the background between the city and BD on this, but they weren't able to come to an agreement on it.
Or finally, they could just take them to court. But as the CBC article we'll put in the show notes mentions, you don't tend to want to sue the level of government that is responsible for your future projects, or they might get even more critical of you.
Yeah, but on the flip side, though, there's been some criticism of the board's vote on this one because, you know, it did seem to somewhat overstep the bounds a bit because the project did conform to all the requirements. And while the decision was couched in terms of design considerations, I mean, reading between the lines, it's fairly obvious that this was a political decision as much as a design decision.
So where the activists in Chinatown wanted to see or want to see a purely social housing development, something that doesn't gentrify the neighborhood, doesn't basically come in with a bunch of high-priced condos as they see it. In South Vancouver, in Marpole, people are really opposed to the idea of social housing. The city there has proposed, through a press release, doing 78 units of temporary modular housing in the area, and local residents have gone apocalyptic, claiming this is going to bring junkies and homeless and all kinds of riffraff into their neighborhood. And they're using basically all that language and much worse, and have started protesting because can't have social housing in that neighborhood, even as they want it in Chinatown.
Yeah, so there's, I mean, it's basically every kind of standard NIMBY talking points reared its ugly head in this one. So yeah, the 78 units of modular housing, there's already a modular housing thing. This would be the second one. It's one at Terminal and Main, I think, and it's, yeah, been there fine. It hasn't caused any problems, but, you know, that doesn't stop the Marpole residents from getting up in arms about, you know, other people moving into their neighborhood who they don't want. Yeah, so they've raised a big stink about it. There was a protest today at City Hall over it, and it's the usual, oh my god, think of the children sort of bullshit that nevertheless comes up here. What I think has actually been kind of interesting is how this has played out in terms of a lot of the activists in kind of the Vancouver housing circles on this one. Interestingly, former mayoral candidate, you know, Wong, who ran for COPE in the last election, the, I guess, furthest left mainstream party in local politics here, has largely spent the last couple days backing the concerns of the residents there rather than going to bat for the social housing, which seems very off-brand.
So I think she got taken a bit out of context on some of her Twitter comments. Metro News did a good interview with her and actually with urban planner Andy Yan talking about what their concerns are around this project. And I think neither of them come out and say they're either super for it or super against it. I imagine they're both sympathetic to it. But what they're taking issue to, as far as I can tell, is Vision Vancouver's approach of basically launching a press conference before they've held any local meetings, so local residents feel like they got steamrolled.
Yeah, though this did go to a vote for council. It was hardly a secret about it. You know, people could have lodged their issues then. They've had consultation earlier in the week on it, or public
forum. Although
their
consultation, the forum they did have, apparently there was a queue out the door because the city planners wanted to a very small meeting to, quote, allow for productive dialogue, which that's fine if you have enough of them that you're able to actually get everyone who wants to say something. Otherwise, you still feel like you're doing it more of as a show. And I think building that local dialogue is what Wong and Yan are trying to say would help diffuse some of these tensions and concerns and anti-poverty sentiments, particularly since both of them have been going in the Chinese media trying to do just that.
There is definitely some areas where the city could have probably handled the or the rollout of this a little better, but you know, at the same time, almost all of the comments I've seen, particularly from Wan, have been criticizing the rollout rather than supporting the social housing, which is what I kind of really expect. And especially kind of when the consultations are a fairly typical thing you see raised as complaints to basically block any project. There's not enough consultations on it. You saw that with the Kiefer thing, despite the fact that this has been going on for like at least 5 years now. Before that, there was the rezoning of Chinatown, where there's even more consultations. It's a very common thing where nobody ever comes out and says, we don't want social housing, period. It's always, maybe shouldn't just be right here. We need more consultations on it. So it definitely plays into the normal tactics that are used to kill these sorts of projects or delay them indefinitely. And if you aren't at least as vocal for it, it's more or less equivalent to being at least softly against it, maybe.
I think part of the tension for activists within COPE, and this applies to the Green Party as well, is they have a very fundamental grassroots democratic value system. It's local residents should be able to make these decisions. And that unfortunately means sometimes they make what they would otherwise see as the wrong decisions. And how they balance that tension is tough because you want to be able to say, look, we support local residents having a voice. And you don't want to say, except when that voice is wrong, because otherwise you look like a hypocrite.
But at the same time, can you really claim like to have, you know, progressive credentials if your requirement for social housing is only when the wealthy landowners here consent to it? And that's the problem I see with some of those sorts of the neighborhood must agree to it. And
well, clearly the solution here is just for Beattie to build his building in Marpole and the modular homes to go in Kiefer Street, and then everyone's happy. Except maybe Ryan, but
I would not be surprised if the Marpole residents would also go out and complain about a 90 unit condo tower going up in their neighborhood too.
There are quite a few new condo towers in that area along the Canby stretch, at least. But yeah.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me if it also faced local opposition here. And something else that I've noticed here, and it's been kind of interesting, is that, okay, so the Kiefer activists complained a lot about how there wasn't enough social housing here, and that was their big thing, you know, even though Beattie's a business, you can't necessarily make money just right outright doing social housing. They didn't really... I never saw a really compelling way to kind of get to 100% social housing that isn't just flat out expropriating the land and somehow finding a whole bunch of money to build onto it. And
mansion tax.
But yeah. And Ashley, I was just about to bring up Gene Swanson here.
Say, we're relitigating the by-election now.
Yeah. So you have the, where a lot of the activists have been complaining, oh, not enough social housing here. But, you know, when we have a social housing project coming up in Marple, that's 100% social housing. The thing that ostensibly they've been lobbying for, you know, you're basically nothing on it. Yeah, I've looked at a lot of kind of the more prominent activists on this, and I've basically seen nothing from them on the Marple housing. Gene Swanson, few comments on Kiefer, nothing on the modular housing, despite the fact that it's was a major part of her election platform. So I'm kind of left wondering, you know, what the hell? Are you actually supporting this or not? And like, it does kind of push the Kiefer opposition into more of a, this seems just more NIMBYism than anything else, because we can discuss whether or not there should be more or less social housing as a part of development or whatnot. But if you want social housing and you don't show up for it when it's actually out there and there's, you know, real opposition to it forming, it's kind of not hard to not see that as this was an opportunistic thing to kill more housing that in their neighborhood.
Well, and finally, maybe a bit lighter note to end on. The BC Ministry of Environment and the BC Fish and Wildlife Branch are being sued by one Todd Standing for, quote, dereliction of duty pertaining to the interests of an indigenous wildlife species. Standing. He runs a operation called Discovering Bigfoot, and he believes there is a Sasquatch near Golden Ears in Harrison Hot Springs, but unfortunately it's not very receptive to his investigations, and the government hasn't helped him at all. So he's hoping to literally prove in court, because this is how science works now, that Bigfoot exists. And suing the government is how he'll get there. He's been working on this lawsuit for over a year, but unfortunately couldn't find any lawyers to take this on for some reason. I imagine he has some money, because his operation, which you can visit at his website, Sylvanic, SYLVANIC.com, and we'll put that in the show notes for sure, offers Sasquatch expeditions for a mere $4,800 US. And that gets you a 7-day, 6-night package where you go from Calgary into the woods with this man in a small group and look for Bigfoot. He's also quite controversial in the Bigfoot community, as Team Sasquatch in USA, and that's Sasquatch in with an IN apostrophe, questioned his credentials, asking if he was, quote, a legit Bigfoot researcher or a hoaxer, because some of his footage he's released online has been controversial within the Bigfoot community.
Yeah, that's my favorite part of this, is apparently there's such a thing as a legitimate Sasquatch researcher.
We found his court filings before, but didn't feel like paying the $6 to read it right now, which, come on, BC government, you don't need to charge $6 for me to download a PDF. But my favorite part of this whole story was Attorney General David Eby's comments on this. Let's note that he chuckled when asked about a civil action regarding an alleged Bigfoot cover-up, and his quote is, "It's top secret, and I can't talk about it." So, good luck, Mr. Standing. I hope you get standing to bring your case forward, and perhaps when the government files its replies, we'll get friend of the pod, Micah, to break it down for us and tell us if Bigfoot's real.
Yeah, this will be fun, because all the best cases are when people represent themselves. So even though we haven't read it, I'm sure there's some delightfully unhinged parts of his complaint.
To his credit, most paranormal websites you come across look like Time Cube level, you know, mid-90s nonsense. His website's actually pretty flashy. It's got like a video playing in the background and looks like a nice modern website, except for the hit counter at the bottom, which is a beautiful throwback, but he has over 9 million hits, so credit to Todd Standing for that.
And that has been Politkos. Find links to the stories we mentioned in the show notes at politkos.ca. Make sure to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts and follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Politkos Pod. Leave us a review and let us know what you think. Support the show and get early access to our interviews at patreon.com/politkos. If you have ideas for the show, feel free to send them to us. Thanks for listening.